One mass shooting after another has plagued America at an increasing rate. The response by many in seats of leadership has been to really take a path those who are seeking to hunt down humans out of either anger or mental illness, terrorism, many other catalysts, they all but laugh at. Right, new gun laws. This reaction has inspired my next guest, who is a successful author, to divert from his normal writing of science fiction and fantasy to take a new route, as evidenced by his latest book, In Defense of the Second Amendment. We say hello to Larry Correa. How are you today, Larry?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for writing a book that clarifies elements of a debate which gets lost in a lot of, prejudice, reality twisting, whatever the case may be. Larry's website, by the way, for his normal 9-to-5 writing, monsterhunternation.com. Just to set the foundation for the person listening, Larry, if someone asks you, is the Second Amendment an absolute? How do you respond?
Yes, the Second Amendment, it means what it says, and that has been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court in recent times. The Second Amendment is for the citizens to have the right to defend themselves with arms against pretty much everything up to and including our own government. And I go there, I talk about the history of it, and I talk about the court cases, and I talk about the examples from it. But yeah, the Second Amendment is vital. It is a check and balance. They oftentimes think of check and balance as being various pieces of the government checking each other. In this case, this is the ultimate check on a government becoming tyrannical. So yes, the Second is absolute, and it's absolutely vital. And as a perk, we also can use it to defend ourselves from, more mundane, normal problems like crime and crazy people who are out there doing violent, horrible things. It's absolutely vital, and we got to defend it.
And we will get to your book of In Defense of the Second Amendment in a moment, but something of more timely nature, too, and this is something that you had posted at townhall.com. We've linked to this column. It's called A Deeper Look into the ATF Ruling on Pistol Braces. That caught your attention. And as you would expect listening, a government agency ruling is not a simple one-page statement. In this case, it was 293 pages with a lot of hidden tricks in it. But for the novice, what is a pistol brace and why was this such a concern for the ATF?
Well, a pistol brace is something that has been out for about a decade. And they were perfectly legal during that time to buy, own, put on your guns. And what it is made for larger pistols. That would be a device you would stick on the end of the gun. Basically, you could balance it against your arm. It was also for people who were handicapped, who had physical upper body strength, the elderly, that kind of thing. They could also be pressed against your shoulder. They weren't stocks, and the ATF said they weren't stocks, but we could hold them in a way that we could use them like a stock. Now, they came out with this 10 years ago, and we went to the ATF and we said, "Are you sure you're okay with this?" And they said, "Yeah, fine. It's perfectly legal." Then for the next decade, we bought millions of them. Millions and millions of Americans bought these because they were perfectly legal. They were on store shelves everywhere. You could walk into any sporting goods store in most of the country and buy one of these, and lots of people did. The ATF says there's 3 million in circulation. That number is actually probably closer to 40 million. But from industry sources, because they've been selling them, owned by millions of Americans. And then the ATF has just recently, a couple weeks ago, decided that that's no longer the case. They have arbitrarily changed the rule. And everyone who has that now has 120 days to register them with the government on a database, the NFA database, or destroy them, or you're a felon. And if you get caught with one of these, it's 10 years in prison. And the kicker of this is these were bought by millions of regular people who don't follow the news on gun rights. This is pretty obscure. Even people who follow politics don't know about this. Millions of Americans are going to be committing felonies, according to the ATF, because they don't know about this. And it's pretty awful. That's actually the potential legal ramifications of this for so many innocent people is just insane. And the ATF just did it completely arbitrarily. Congress did not pass a law. This is just the government, one government agency saying, okay, we're going to make 40 million of you criminals. Boom. And so it's a mess. And that's going on right now.
Again, asking on behalf of the novice that might be listening, does a pistol brace magnify, increase the power of the gun that it's attached to in any way, shape, or form?
No, it does not. In fact, the caliber remains the same. The barrel length remains the same. It's just a thing on the end that actually makes it easier to hold, is really what it is. It just makes it more comfortable to shoot. It doesn't make the gun any more lethal. It doesn't do anything like that. And the ATF, in fact, in their ATF justification in those 293 pages, they cite that this makes powerful weapons concealable, which is madness because there are perfectly legal, more powerful weapons that are more concealable. And putting a pistol brace onto an existing pistol actually makes it less concealable. So the ATF's justification that they put in their ruling actually doesn't make any logical sense whatsoever.
So Larry Correa, you may probably know him best for his sci-fi and fantasy writing, but his new book, taking quite the different route, In Defense of the Second Amendment, monsterhunternation.com, his website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. Let's turn to your book, In Defense of the Second Amendment. Obviously, the idea of gun-free zones, that's just basically angry shooters welcome as far as anyone with a realistic look at the human condition is concerned. I wanted to talk with you about red flag laws. You say they don't work. Can they work if done properly? My philosophy had always been, I've seen, and it varies so much from state to state, you can submit an affidavit as a healthcare professional. There's teletestimony. Put everyone in courtroom to be questioned by both sides, have to respond to both sides. Everything has to be upfront, in person, and able to be challenged for a red flag law process to be fair and effective.
Yeah, the problem with the red flag laws, and they vary from state to state, is that there is no real protections there other than one judge stamping off on it. And as we've seen in some places, judges will stamp off on literally anything. And we've seen that they're ripe for abuse. So all it takes is someone who has an axe to grind saying, I have some sort of knowledge or relationship with this person, and he is a danger to himself and others, and he is armed, and he's going to do something bad. All they have to do is file that red flag. Judge stamps off. Police will then immediately go to that person's house, raid it, seize their firearms, and take them away. Now, we have two problems here. The first problem is that this is giving the worst people in the world the ability to weaponize law enforcement against you. And it doesn't require any the burden of proof is nothing. So we've already had cases where angry employees have done this to their boss. We've had this where angry family members have done this against, like, a spouse has done this against ex-wife kind of thing. We've had a situation in Colorado where a police officer shot somebody in the line of duty. It was ruled a justifiable shooting. And the mother of the person who got shot filed a red flag on the police officer. She didn't even know him in real life. And that still went through. And then once this happens to you and it's weaponized against you, you have to go to court. You have to spend money on lawyers. Who knows how much time? All the fight to get your rights back. We've had actually the weirdest one I just got. I don't have the details on this one yet, but stalker using it against the woman he was stalking, so she would be disarmed, and that was fine. That was part of that worked under the law. So it's crazy. The second problem is, let's say if you do actually have a violent, deranged, listless loner who is planning to do something bad. You red flag him. Cops come, raid his house. He's now even angrier. They take his weapons away. Well, he's still free. That red flag is commitment. He's not been committed to a mental institution or anything. He's still free. There's absolutely nothing stopping him from procuring another gun the same way that most criminals procure guns, which is buying them from someone who stole them or stealing them themselves. Or there's nothing stopping him from going to Home Depot and building a bomb, or even just driving his car down the sidewalk.
Very true.
And we've seen all these things happen. So, yeah, red flags, I think they are ripe for abuse, and they logically fall apart as far as stopping it, as far as the evidence, statistical evidence, on whether they work or not. There is almost no evidence of that either way, because they're trying to combat an event that's so statistically odd and doesn't happen hardly ever. That's hard to say if it makes a statistical dent or not. Because mass killings, mass shootings, Contrary to what the media declares, there are not hundreds of them. Any given year, there's a few. There's like maybe a dozen. The media likes to pretend that there's hundreds and hundreds, but most of those are just, you know, gang and drug-related violence, like most gun crime. And they portray those as mass shootings. Red flags are going to do nothing for any of those.
Got about a minute and change left here. Why does somebody need to own an AR-15?
Honestly, the AR-15 is useful, and it's the most popular rifle in America for a reason. It's easy to shoot. It's simple. It's reliable. It's handy, and it's popular. The media has fixated on the AR-15 as the thing they want to ban because it's so popular and common. It'd be like saying we want to ban the Honda Accord because the Honda Accord is the car that's statistically used in the most crimes. That's because it's the most common car in America. That's the same thing with the AR-15. That said, rifles are hardly ever used in crime. In fact, the vast majority of crime are not involving rifles. But when I was a kid, they wanted to ban AK-47s because that was the thing in the news.
It is an interesting approach to take when you look at an element of our society that has so many positions coming at it, but there's two basic purposes. One is to empower the Second Amendment. The other one is to defuse the Second Amendment. What Larry does with In Defense of the Second Amendment, it shows the means by which you could be the empowerment and the protector of it through facts and reality, as opposed to the imaginary what-ifs, which when it comes to anything to do with liberty, with laws, and with rights, what-ifs are not always the best way to go. They certainly bring about discussion and debate, which is always needed, but hopefully it's logic that brings about the eventual conclusion. And I think Larry's book, In Defense of the Second Amendment, is part of the tools to get to that conclusion. Learn more about Larry's all of his work and his writing at monsterhunternation.com. We've linked to his townhall.com column as well over at our homepage. Larry Correa, thanks for what you are adding to what is certainly a debate with a lot of volume and a lot of misrepresentation that your book, I believe, is going to be a response to. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me on.